So we did a little experiment, a meditation experiment, seeing what it was like to open the mind, send good wishes in the form of light or energy or just your own, you know, ideation, just your own imagination. Seeing if that made you feel more or less tense or relaxed or what that was like for you. Maybe you've done this many times before. Maybe you've never even thought of doing it before. This is important practice. It's the practice that we've been talking about during these Tuesdays. So, I don't know what you felt, especially if this is something quite new, but, you know, there can be quite a difference in our experience when our mind is really zeroed in on something, like a computer, or even on another person's face when we're engaged in a whole lot of ideation about them. We think they're beautiful and wonderful. We think they're nasty and saying the wrong thing. You know, usually our minds are not blank when we are looking engaged with another person. We are usually full of something or other. We're having fun. We're having a good conversation. We're wishing it were a little different. We're wishing we could get out of here. We wish they would look at us more affectionately. You know, all these things, all these kinds of judgments, these always trying to fix things. We're always noticing how things aren't quite the way we want them. And so there's that kind of thing going on. And so we were practicing not doing that. I don't know how that went for you. It's kind of a gentle experiment that might not knock you over the head the first time you do it. But what about being able just to hold an area of space and whoever happens to be in that space and just be open and just be not reactive, not pushing away or trying to pull in? When was the last time you talked to somebody without trying either to kind of really, you know, get their attention in some way or keep them off you in some way, the push-pull? That's one of the main things that goes on among people, isn't it? We want people to be closer, we want them to be further away, and they're usually not quite the way we want them to be, and there's always this adjustment. So the possibility of just kind of being open and present is pretty radical, actually. It's pretty radical in the sense that it's not our habit. It's not my habit. Is it your habit? You know, just, oh, I'm like a mirror, just reflecting whatever. No, I want you to do this and I want you to do that. And so I just wondered if you had any, you know, if that was, I don't know, impactful to you, if you noticed anything, if you noticed maybe even your own resistance. Sometimes the most valuable thing that can happen when we do a meditation practice is we notice our resistance to it. And I really want to acknowledge how valuable that is, because very often, more often than not, here or even maybe more at Rice in the famous contemplative practicum that Bill Hart Parsons and I teach, so people who are completely new and who are to meditation, you are basically a rise to get good grades and good careers and get into graduate school, right? And many of them do. So that's not about relaxing. That's not about not trying to fuss with the future and be in the moment. So just sit here and, you know, just allow whatever is occurring in this moment to occur. Well, it's one way of expressing love and acceptance for yourself. And it's also one way of offering love and acceptance to somebody else. There's a kind of wisdom in it. The wisdom that, you know, hey, you're not the only person in the world who wants to be happy. So does the next person. Oh, whew. You know, I don't know. I think that's very... To me, there's something very relaxing about recognizing that. You know, the world isn't full of strangers, actually. The world is full of people who are exactly like me. And they don't look like me in many ways, and we behave differently and so on. But in this very fundamental way, we are so similar. I don't know. When I think of that, it's just kind of like an exhale. And I studied a little bit about this, Shantideva and some of the great Chandrakirti, some of these great Indian teachers, and a little bit of Tibetan commentaries on them. Also, the first time I went to India, I so wanted to go to India. That was like my dream. I just had to go to India. I had no idea why. Then I met him, and he wanted to go to India too, luckily. And so that worked out well. And I just was, I really wanted to go to India, and I was so happy to land in India. But I felt like I didn't understand anything. You know, the body English is really different. I can't do it. You know, I didn't know, are they saying yes or are they saying no? I'm like, I couldn't understand this basic thing. And, you know, the smells are different. I loved everything, but it's really different. And I felt like, I don't really know, you know, I don't really quite know what, it's a little bit like being on a different planet. And then I remembered what Shanti Deva said, and he said that everybody wants happiness and the causes of happiness. I remember the moment it struck me. We were crossing this huge street in Bombay, and it seemed like there were hundreds of people, you know, coming towards me in saris and kalwar sameez, and just Sikhs, just all the variety of people that are in India, and they're all coming and all looking so different from people that I had seen before. And then I thought, oh, I get it. They're not strange at all. They want to be happy, just like I want to be happy. And I don't know, this is a really kind of, it's a really simple thing, but it's kind of a profound thing. You know, we put up so much fences between ourselves and others, and those fences make us very tense. I don't understand what this person is like. I don't know their culture. I don't know their customs. I should do this. I should do that. Well, it's good to learn about other people's ways of doing things, certainly, but the fundamental strangeness that is so taxing, I think, on the nervous system really can dissipate, I think, to a large extent. Oh, they don't want to be happy. I want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. I don't want to suffer. Okay, high five. We're on that one together. You know, I don't know. I think it's a very beautiful thing. And it's also an orientation that has a lot of space in it. So a lot of the way we are ordinarily is, especially in modernity, especially maybe in the West, is, you know, we're very into this idea that we are individuals. And, I mean, obviously we have separate bodies, but we tend to feel more than necessary that we are kind of locked up inside our silhouette. You know, like I just end here, which is ridiculous. Because I'm breathing in air that comes from all over and has come from all over, and I'm eating food, as we've talked about and Harvey has talked about, that has come from all over, and that's what's keeping me alive. I'm not just this kind of very limited profile, but we tend to feel that way much of the time. And that's a very small place to live in, you know, just between your heels and your head. There's not a lot of territory there. And we have so much to concern ourselves with, so many details, so many worries, so many things to take care of, so many emails, so many this and this and this and this and this. And I think, I've thought for a long time since I've been reflecting on this, that this modern idea, you know, Walter Ong, who's a great scholar of oral traditions and how, and the difference it makes in a culture when literacy comes in. You know, there was a time before now when people didn't all have books, and the main thing that they did to get information wasn't to look at letters or much less to look into a computer. And he said that with the coming of books as a entity prevalent everywhere, people, that means us, started to conceive of ourselves as kind of like between the covers of a book, you know, so that the thoughts and feelings that we have are kind of like inside here and nobody can see them unless we open a page to a friend, special friend, we open special pages to and say something about what's inside us. But otherwise, it's kind of all in here and all kind of stuck in it. Honestly, feels pretty cramped and crowded, and no wonder we're freaking out all the time with stress. And with a sense of being cramped and not having enough space in our lives, in our minds, in our hearts. So it is very soothing, and I think very kind of educational, to sometimes just sit and look at a little bit of space. Oh. And is that space outside you? Well, it's outside my body, but I mean, I can see it. It's part of my experience. Even if I look from here to the moon, I think that's one of the reasons it's so wonderful to look at the night sky or the ocean or mountains, because, I mean, they're out there, but in another way, they're right here. They're part of our field of experience. They're part of what is forming our experience at this moment. And that gives us a lot of space to live in. And to cultivate compassion, love and compassion, not to mention wisdom, which is what we're mainly talking about in these Tuesdays, we need a whole lot of space. Because wisdom is big, compassion is big, the number of beings who need to receive our love and compassion. We said here, may all beings always have happiness and its causes. All beings. Well, all beings are not here in this room. They're all over the place. And the Buddhist view, and maybe science too, they're everywhere, or they're potentially everywhere. Who knows? These seven planets that are so titillating right now, four of which maybe they have life, maybe they're little bugs in the ice there because they probably have water. Oh my God, life! 40 light years away, life. Never mind, 100 billion light years away, life. Just thinking of it, just saying those words is a little bit intoxicating, no? 40 billion light years? Of course, I can't really imagine what 40 billion light years is, but nonetheless, it's big. And I feel it, you know, I feel it as a lot bigger than what I'm usually involved with. And somehow, I like it. Don't you like it? 40 billion? Is it 40? No, it's 40 light years, right? 40 light years. Is that big enough? We could say 40 billion. We don't really know. You know, whatever does it for you to open your mind a little bit and say, whoa. Now, why is that important? Because we're seeking, it's important for wisdom and compassion. So for beings are limitless. I'm talking Buddhist language now. So we often talk about beings are vast as space, a very common phrase. The living beings for whom we are cultivating compassion, they are arrayed out in an area that is as vast as space. So that's an invitation. Think of space. Think of how vast that is. So, even just looking at a little bit of space and cultivating a sense of just being open to it and accepting of it and with it, you know, not thinking of the past, thinking of the future, just space. It's just here, now. Oh, there's an infinite amount of this. Now I know a little bit of what space is. At least I'm not stuck inside my head like I usually am. I'm looking here. Oh, there's space. Oh, space. And there's umpteen trillion more of this, you know, wedge of space throughout the world, the universe, and it's all filled. Buddhists feel there's beings everywhere. We won't go into that, right? But it's kind of an enlivening way to envision. You know, part of these meditations are not just that something is scientifically verifiable, but how does it impact us to imagine that there's some kind of livingness everywhere? Vast as space. There are living beings throughout space. We don't really know. You know, many traditions believe that there are invisible beings. We're not just talking about animals and humans, spirits, demons, angels. But the point of it for us in cultivating compassion is to begin to be oriented to having a sense of compassion or loving wishes that kind of go out everywhere, because you never know who's going to might pass through any part of space. It's really a kind of seamless expanse of reality that we are invited to come in contact with and to fill that with a sense of love and compassion. So to speak about the spaciousness that is accessible to our own experience is a path both to wisdom and compassion. Because wisdom, we often hear, particularly in the writings of Longchenpa, great figure of the ancient tradition of Buddhism in Tibet, space, it teaches us a lot. Our nature is a lot more like space than we think. What do you think your nature is? Do you think it's flesh and blood? Do you think it's particular emotion that you have fleetingly from time to time? Great hatred, great love, great nervousness, great stress. Do you think that's your nature? Really your nature? So when we think of our nature in terms of these traditions, we think of it as something that is as open and has as much potential as space itself. Anything can come into space. That's what's so great about space, right? Where you look at an empty stage, it's exciting already, right? Because you know something's going to happen and it's going to happen there. Well, that's true everywhere. Something's going to happen and it's going to happen, you know, in the space of your experience. When our science talks about how there is so much space between atoms, how all of the matter of this entire universe, if the space were taken out between the atoms, it would be something like this large. Isn't that amazing? It's like crazy. That means that, wait a second, then that means that my sense that there's all of this matter, obstructive matter all over the place, walls and buildings and roads and bridges and cars and trains and all of that. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff in the universe, don't you? Moons and planets and seems like there's a lot of stuff. And it's real stuff. It's really obstructive stuff. You know, I can't put my hand through this, even this plastic thing here. It seems very solid. Now, wait a second. Are you telling me that not just all the things in this room, which would already be pretty amazing, not just this whole building, which would ever also already be like unbelievably astonishing, not just the whole NRG and Astrodome and all of that, but everything, all of the space in this whole universe, all of the matter in this whole universe, if you poofed out all of the space of it, that's keeping the atoms and neutrons and all of that apart from each other, and really clumped it all down together, you'd just have, it'd be about this big, is what I've read. It's what they say. So that means that my idea that these things are so solid has got to be kind of wrong. There's so much space in it. Never mind in our own bodies. We're mostly water anyway. We know, I remember the first time in maybe a fourth or fifth grade, it's like, you're mostly water. It's like, what? Certainly not mostly water. I'm my unique, creative, interesting ideas. No, you're not. You're mostly water. So thinking about space in this way is one way, a little bit combination of modern and traditional way, to reflect on the unreality of everything that we think we know is real. It's not what we think. Things are not as solid. Even our science says that now. And Buddhism has been saying this, they've been saying this in India for thousands of years. Now science is catching up. Thank you very much. So that must mean, if everything's just kind of like froth on space, then And if space is mostly what's going on, space, emptiness, reality, Buddha nature, you know, these different words that are somewhat synonymous, then it must mean that self and other, me and you, you, right? Me and you, we can't be all that different, all that separate, all that excluding of each other either. Once we start to break down what seem to be the very hard boundaries of body and world and self and all of that, there's a little bit of a melting when we start to focus on space. Then that means the territory, the line that separates me from you, you can't draw a line in space. Lama Khonsan Phelden says that in talking about Shantideva in the 8th chapter, in case you want to know where this is coming from. There's nothing to cut up, you know? Can't slice space. So if you can't slice space in two, and if we're mostly space, then the justification for caring so much about what's going on here and not at all about what's going on in your part of space, maybe that's not the right way to do it. Maybe that's not really in tune with reality. Is it making any sense? Really? A few over here, not so much over here. So, okay, we can talk about this more concretely also. When we talk about, so in the over, you know, we're talking about the connection between wisdom and compassion in the Buddhist traditions. And we're talking about the more we understand something about how we ourselves are just a concatenation resulting from causes and conditions that actually go back through the beginning of time, if there were such a thing, and to the very ends of space also. Even our science says that. You know, we're basically made from stardust, stars that were born, I don't know how many billions of years ago. That's crazy. That's what science says. But as practitioners, Buddhism has said something very similar from the very beginning. And we're interested in how it impacts us to try to really relate to this as something that might help us orient to our lives, you know, in a deeper way, in a way that's more somehow realistic. So, if you can slash a line, cut up space, and if we're kind of mostly space, you know, empty, selfless, reality, Buddha nature, Dharma Dhatu, then again, the dividing line between self and other becomes a little more mysterious. Seems obvious. I'm not you, you're not me, that's clear. You're wearing a blue shirt, I'm wearing an honest shirt. I get it, right? But if we start looking at it from this other way, then there's something that happens that's a little more, I think, relaxed, a little more open. Or maybe we're all just waves in the ocean of space. That's different. That's different than we ordinarily think of ourselves. Waves in the ocean of space. So that means we're still separate, but there's something incredibly profound and pervasive and important and essential to our being that also connects us all. This is called having your cake and eating it too, because we're not denying that we are, you know, male and female and in between and different religions and races and cultures and sometimes happy and sometimes sad. Some people behave well, some people behave badly. But, you know, there are storms in the ocean. The waves sometimes are really high, and sometimes the ocean is just flat like glass. But it's always ocean. Water is the thing. And we fixate on the waves and the foam and the tides and maybe the boats and the eels and all of that. But water, water is the nature. So if it's true that in some meaningful way we are all just expressions in the waves of space, starry space, you know, stardust and space, there has to be some kind of energy that's dynamically expressing itself as us at this moment, then we are not as different as we seem. Then we are all somehow waves in the ocean, somehow light in the sky. And then maybe compassion becomes easier, makes more sense. You know, would one wave say, okay, I'm going to get to shore. Who cares about you? It's not quite like that, right? There's not a... Anyway, so in Shantideva is the great Shantideva, 8th century India, author of the Bodhisattva Charyavatara, often translated as Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. It's kind of the core Buddhist textbook on bringing together wisdom with compassion. Yes, we sang a verse from Shantideva, the last chapter. We sang, for as long as space abides, understanding that space is filled with living beings, as long as the world remains, space and time, so long may I be there, resolving all beings' pain. We are told that this is the Dalai Lama's favorite verse. This is the heart and core of the Bodhisattva. I want to help everyone for as long as it takes. You know, rather far from our normal orientation, no doubt. But if we can even be moved and inspired by this a tiny little bit, it is said we have the seed of great awakening within us. So back to our linking of wisdom and compassion. So if we can begin to break down the sense of difference between ourselves and others, then love and compassion is going to come more quickly. It's going to come more easily. And we do this in part, Shantideva does it in a couple different ways. One way, which is familiar to you also from the meditation on the seven cause and effect precepts of Chandrakirti, is to reflect that, well, everybody, as we said already, everybody wants happiness just as much as me. Everybody wants to be free of suffering just as much as me. Now, that itself is a very profound meditation. Can spend a good amount of time, and we do, in fact, when we do the seven cause and effect, just really getting it through our thick skulls that somebody else's, you know, headache or car accident or loss of a pet is just as painful as when it happens to me. And, I mean, that's so obvious, but it's also so not obvious, because our pain always is more, you know, gets our attention, of course, in ways that others' pain doesn't. Why? Why don't others' pain, doesn't others' pain get our attention the same way that our own pain does? Well, we feel it. And we feel that this is us and that's them and they're different. And so everything is going to be different. So that's kind of like the emotional way of bringing about a kind of equanimity. And we've talked about that somewhat before. Just recognizing that everybody has the same wants. Everybody's hand hurts if it's put in a flame or you hit it with a hammer. Shantideva's Yidam, his deity that he had visions with and personal conversations with, was Manjushri. Where's Manjushri? Over there? Where? Oh, Manjushri with his sword. His on the right there. Manjushri, his sword cutting the root of ignorance. So Manjushri is considered to be the embodiment of all of the wisdom of all of the Buddhas of the past, present and future. That's how Buddhism likes to do things. They take this as the all of the wisdom and the whole universe looks like this. Looks like Manjushri. So in one sense he's a being, but in another sense he's a, you know, an expression of a quality that we seek to cultivate. And maybe in the West we're more comfortable talking about, you know, Manjushri as expressing a quality of wisdom than as, a being. But in any case, he's really both. Everybody here is really both. So Shantideva, Manjushri was like his tutor. And so for Manjushri, he really, the way he teaches love and compassion, he brings in elements of understanding that are also very much connected with the breaking down of dualism that is fundamentally part of the development of wisdom itself. And he does this around not just subject and object in general, but self and other. It's not just that self and other are the same because we want happiness and don't want suffering. Self and other are the same. It is possible to come. He's really addressing the, you know, very natural protest that we might all feel. How could I possibly, I mean, really, give me a break. How could I really care about somebody else's pain and suffering as much as mine? I mean, I try and I want to be a nice person and I give, donate to, you know, charities and I want everybody to be safe and have health insurance or whatever, but really, really, really. And he says, and some of you, you know, we've talked about this before, but part of what practice is to see things afresh, you know, even if you've heard them before, to see, well, how does this resonate with me right now? So what about it? You know, the thing that's most ours, this, right, the body, me, my body, my body, my body, don't mess with me, you know, don't, certain appropriate boundaries around the body. And we cherish the body among all, above all things. Later, if you end up doing cycles, we'll, I won't tell you what we'll do. Right now, though, we're exploring how we, first of all, recognizing how we really feel, you know, it's ours. Not only is the body ours, but the things that are that we physically or legally have control over, this is I and this is mine. Do you understand? This is my computer. That means it belongs to me. That means it's okay if I carry it around in my bag and do whatever I want with it. It is totally not okay for you even to open it without my permission because it's mine. Mine. The idea of mine, which Chandrakirti says that the source that I and mine, this conviction in I and mine is really what it sets the whole process of reactivity going that keeps us in the samsara of repeated habits, continually repeating activities that don't work very well for us, but we keep doing them because it's a kind of inertia, samsara, it just keeps rolling. But what undergirds all of these habits is that we feel that this is me. It's not you. And how could I ever come to regard you in the same way that I regard me? It's a legitimate question, don't you think? And then he says, well, you know, the substances that came out of your parents, how did your body get here anyway? Did you say, I think I like a body now? Well, maybe in some sense we did, actually, if we look at the Buddhist theory of reincarnation. But, you know, we couldn't just conjure up a body, even if we were consciousness enough to know that we wanted one in between lives. You know, we've got to enter another body. In a case of this life, we enter our mother's womb. Yay. Yay? No. We're stuck there. You know, we have to grow in this rather constrained environment for some time. But even in the womb, you know, we have preferences. The mother moves this way or that way or is hot or cold and we're more or less comfortable. Even in the womb, there's a sense of my body. This is me. But where did that body come from? So Lama Gunpan, in the Nectar of Manjushri, a commentary on Shantideva's text. He says, well, really, these things from which your body originate have nothing to do with you. There's no way that your parents, you know, blood and sperm are yours. It's theirs. I think it's funny too. It's like verse 111, chapter 8. It's quite astounding. Because it makes so much sense, and yet it's so nonsensical to our ordinary way of thinking. So what happened? This stuff that is totally not, it never was yours, never could be yours, comes together, gets a little thicker, grows up, and then somehow you inhabit it as a consciousness, and you think, oh, this is mine. This is me. And we don't think at all. Thank you, Mother and Father, for providing me with a body. We don't think that. I mean, we do if we learn these traditions, and we do think about it quite a lot. But ordinarily, especially in this culture, as teenagers, forget about it. So the very interesting koan we can rest with for another 2 weeks at least, if not another, 2 years or two lifetimes, is how about that? Did you not already learn in some phylogenetic way, to see what in fact we can recognize was not ours? And then it grows, and then, we forget about the source. We forget about cause and effect. For Buddhism, this is always a path to living in illusion. I just think that something just is. I just popped out, Here I am. I'm great. Well, his point is, we've already actually somehow learned to regard what is actually other as self. Why could we not learn it again in a way that sees others as self in this, not that we mix up identity, but in the sense of that my concern for their, for your, for our happiness and suffering is as great and powerful as it is for my own, because we are equal. We are equal because self and other are really not as different as we thought. So this is quite a different kind of existential, dependent, arising, wisdom-based way of looking at the equality of self and other. And this Shantideva talks about right off, this part of it, he talks about right off in the verse 90 of chapter 8. And you can read Lama Gumpel's commentary just on that, just on those verses. If you read just the commentary on verse 90 and verse 111, that's already quite a lot, and it's not very many pages. Okay, I'm going to stop there. Quite enough, no?
If you enjoyed this teaching, please visit our website, donmountain.org, to subscribe to this course and find other great Dharma offerings. May all beings always have happiness and its causes. May all beings always be free of pain and its causes.